Well, thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. And I acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Global thinking and collaborative action is the only way to solve the coming decade's big challenges, and Australia will be in a prime position to influence global thinking and action, as has just been said, with the Security Council, but also in 2014 as President of the G20. So this is not the time to be taking a pull up the ladder, Jack, we're okay attitude. It is the time for thinking about Australia's role in the region and globally. And as we take centre stage as President in this forum, we do so at a time when there are real challenges in terms of security and stability. The years 2014-15 are also periods of global reckoning, because there will be opportunities but also challenges in terms of cooperation. They're crucial if we're to see effective action on climate change implemented, with the world moving to try to secure a global treaty in 2015. And of course, the global effort to spread development more evenly via the Millennium Development Goals being refreshed in the course of looking at how much we've achieved. But with traditional growth forecasters suggesting there'll also be a slowdown in global economic growth, the challenge is always to keep from slipping into defensive self-interest, which we do see constantly through the UN process as national sovereignty defeats global cooperation almost every time through the UN system. The period as President of the G20 is also a time to remind the international community about Australia's place in the world. As we host the first G20 leaders meeting in the Southern Hemisphere, and only the second time the summit has been held in the Asia-Pacific region, it is an opportunity to firmly state our place in the Asian century. And as a developed country in this region, I think it is going to be quite interesting to see what the world makes of us when they come to Brisbane. And as the preparations for the G20 presidency continue, there is an amount of soul searching going on about the G20 in a general sense. Legitimate questions are being asked about if the forum has lost its way since its apparent strength in 2009, when it responded to the global financial crisis. There is general agreement that the G20 structure did work very well through that crisis, but to remain relevant in guiding the world through its challenges, it has not simply to deal with crisis management, but it has to carve out a path to anticipate the global problems of the future before they materialise and actually threaten security and well-being of billions. And that's why the role of the G20, bringing people together, influential people together, is obviously important to start looking at the broader processes and how this leadership team might work within it. Now, there are many commentators, including in the Lowy Institute, who would like to see the G20 refocus on a narrower agenda just of economic growth. And that's a view that the Greens don't share. Economic growth and fiscal stability cannot be separated from the physical world in which we live. We can't continue to believe in the myth that economic growth can defy the finite limits of our planet. It's the fundamental flaw in economics, believing that people and the planet are somehow externalities. They're central to economic systems. So the G20 must embrace, not run away from, its expanded mandate that includes climate and energy policies, considers the impact of extreme weather events, rethinks the relationship between trade, aid and food security, and addresses global corruption. They're essential matters to be addressed for any stability in the world and hence the economy. And the G20 has the opportunity and the responsibility to lead in these matters. Australia hosting the G20 in Brisbane will bring world leaders face to face with this conundrum. They will see the Great Barrier Reef dying before their eyes. 50% of the coral cover of the Great Barrier Reef has been lost in the last 26 years. We're now seeing the Great Barrier Reef potentially being listed as World Heritage in Danger under the Global Convention. They will be arriving in Brisbane as there's massive debate about the digging up coal ports up and down the Queensland coast, ever-expanding coal seam gas wells, and mining enormous coal deposits, and the argument over that, particularly in the Bowen and Galilee basins. And so as the world comes to Brisbane, they're going to see right in their face the conundrum that has to be faced if we're going to actually survive on a finite planet. So the leaders of the G20 will be in proximity to some of also some of the least developed states, that is in the Pacific, for whom a new trade and aid relationship is essential. Because if you look at, the coming together of the climate crisis, how aid is spent, how trade is worked, and the capacity building that Australia can offer the region, these things will be in people's face in Brisbane. And so we're suggesting that Australia could ensure that some of the smaller voices in our region are heard at the summit. The normal practice as chair is for extra places to be offered to a small number of countries to attend the G20. And the Greens think Australia should invite Pacific nations, obviously PNG, as our closest neighbour, and also some of the small island, least developed states in the Pacific who are at front and centre in terms of the climate crisis. And of course that could be Tuvalu or Kiribati, but we must have Australia inviting our Pacific neighbours to the G20. It's also important to remember that while the G20 represents 80% of global output, it's not representative of more than 80% of the world's countries or people. It has no formal relationship with the 151 non-member countries left outside the G20 tent, and nor does it have a formal relationship with the UN. And that actually has to be addressed. In Copenhagen, for those of you who may have been there in 2009, the world was struggling through the UN process to get to an outcome. In came some of the key leaders, including, of course, President Obama, pulled together a few people in a room, came out with the Copenhagen Declaration, and I can tell you as one of the people there and those the rest of you in the room who may have been there as well, there was enormous resentment that the leaders of some of the most powerful nations in the planet thought they could swan in at the last minute and pull the rug out from the notional view of one vote, one value through the UN system. And so the G20 has to be something that facilitates cooperation, improves global governance, rather than what occurred in that situation, which was to undermine global governance in order to save face and not have a failure, a total failure at Copenhagen, inflow a few people, pulled out something and undermine that notional view about equality in the UN process. So I think Australia could make a start on making the G20 more consultative and accountable by ensuring a stronger relationship with the United Nations, including making permanent observer status of the UN Secretary General a role for the and give the UN a role, a more permanent and strong role in the preparatory meetings. The G20 is not a replacement for the UN on global issues. The UN must never have to feel that it's undermined by the G20 forum. And let's not forget, the G20 has no secretariat, it has no charter, it is essentially a coming together of 20 or so leaders, and having got that mandate, they really have to think to themselves, how can they facilitate outcomes and drive better outcomes when there is essentially a stalemate through other UN processes. So, whilst the UN is the primary body for international cooperation and for maintenance of international peace and security, there's no doubt it needs some help. It's broadened its scope to include, the G20 that is, has broadened its scope to include development and environmental protection in recognition that poverty, inequality and environmental triggers are damaging, are triggers for political instability. And I think the G20 has got a role to play. As a nation with a strong democratic tradition, Australia must also ensure there's strong civil society presence engaged with the summit, including environmental NGOs. I note that the Lowy Institute has also been calling for stronger civil society presence, and I really welcome that. The huge challenges that the global economy faces are intimately linked with global warming and the increasing pressure we're placing on the natural environment. And so I think the G20 can only benefit from a stronger engagement with environmental groups, as well as aid and social justice organisations. And I did meet the Sherpa earlier this year, and I did say to him that I'm disappointed that the consultation to date has been mainly with the social justice and aid community and not with the environment community as well. They are all essential players, and there's no doubt there is going to be a big NGO presence in Brisbane next year, and a large percentage of that will be environmental groups, because it is Brisbane, it is Queensland, it is the Barrier Reef, it is coal and coal seam gas, and much better to have engagement within the system rather than outside and at the gates. In terms of economic stability while addressing global warming, the G20 needs to be preparing their economies for a new era of development focused on avoiding dangerous climate change and shifting away from an economy dependent on fossil fuels. The G20 should be focusing its jobs and growth vision on this challenge while dealing with the underlying challenge of growing inequality that plagues our current models of economic growth and development. The G20 needs to heed the advice, not just of environmentalists and parties such as the Greens, but the World Economic Forum, which in its report More with Less, Scaling Sustainable Consumption and Resource Efficiency, in January this year said, current trends clearly show that business as usual no longer works. Unless the present link between growth and the consumption of scarce resources is severed, our resource base, governance and policy structures are unlikely to sustain the standard of living societies have grown accustomed to or indeed aspire to. Action to decouple business and economic growth from resource intensity and environmental impact has never been more critical to the long-term success of business. And really, that is the challenge for the G20. The question that plagues the reputation of the G20 is whether its golden age was guiding us through the financial crisis. If it wants to demonstrate its importance to global affairs, it's time the G20 firmly acknowledge its role is to lead the world in a new direction, one that moves away from the model of economic growth derived from resource extraction and pollution. A group of global leaders coming together, coming out saying that that is the way they think the global economy should go and that growth has to be seen in that context, would send a really important signal. The G20 has in the past failed to really see this particular conundrum. In the 2009, the leaders' communique, they did acknowledge the need to move to greener, more sustainable growth, and a green growth stream and work plan was introduced in 2012 by the Mexican presidency. But unlike the economic and development agendas, the green growth elements of the 2012 Los Cabos Declaration contain no definition, no principles or pillars in relation to, quote, inclusive green growth. It stated merely that we acknowledge the importance of finding ways in which economic growth, environment protection and social inclusion can complement and reinforce each other. It's hardly an inspiring statement, nor does it put any meat on the bones in how that actually might be done. And it's extremely disappointing that Russia, as the current chair, has dropped disaster risk management and the focus on green growth that were themes in Mexico. Green growth now appears to be relegated to examining the best practice database for green energy and energy efficiency policies. In addition, work on climate change financing has not been listed as one of the priorities of the Russian chair. The G20 will fail to prepare and inspire the world if they simply focus on business as usual. And on that issue of climate financing, that is something ahead of the UNFCCC negotiations trying to get to a global agreement in 2015, if there could be some consensus achieved around how that climate financing for the longer term might be achieved, that would be a major contribution to facilitating an outcome in 2015, because that issue of climate financing has been one of the things that has frustrated attempts to get movement in the UNFCCC process to date. The green growth stream is cited by some of the G20 traditionalists as one of the distracting and divisive agendas that has taken the forum away from its core business of investment and growth. And obviously, I think that is wrong. It is in fact the key to the G20 setting a realistic vision of the future economy and making its focus on a modern, cleaner, more efficient economy for the future. Indeed, without an overarching and ambitious vision, many in the community will rightly ask whether the G20 fulfills any useful role for the future. It will become more of a problem than a solution if it doesn't start saying to the world, what are we growing and how are we measuring what we're growing against the impacts, the adverse impacts that have been recognised for a long time of just measuring well-being and growth in relation to GDP. Furthermore, it's a denial of reality to ignore the increasing frequency of extreme weather events and their potential impacts on the global economy and global security. The US last year spent more on natural disaster recovery than they spent on public transport and educating their citizens. Climate financing must remain on the agenda if those wealthiest nations are to effectively assist developing nations manage the implications of climate change. And similarly, as we get to the notional end of the Millennium Development Goals, we need to refresh the aid agenda. From Australia's perspective, this requires the political leadership to keep our commitment. Instead of using the aid budget as a bucket of money to dip into when we get into fiscal difficulties, Australia should set a target to meet its 0.7% GNI by 2020 and stop pushing back its weaker target of 0.5%. The Greens will meet these targets by investing an additional $4.8 billion over the next 4 years and will stop undermining our aid effort by directing its use to overseas detention of asylum seekers. And I think Australia would be naive if they thought that the G20 is not going to start asking questions about Australia's commitment in terms of overseas aid when people come to realise that we are the third largest recipients of our own overseas aid by virtue of money that we direct to keeping people in asylum. And that would be a situation that needs to be dealt with before we get to the actual G20 meeting. I believe that the G20 is ideally suited to take up the challenge identified by Christine Lagarde, the Managing Director of the IMF, earlier this year, when she called for a new kind of economic growth. She said we need, quote, green growth that respects environmental sustainability, good ecology is good economics. And I really think that until we get a global conversation again about what growth is and what sort of growth can be sustained and how we measure it, then we're just going to end up continuing the way we're going. In terms of fossil fuels, the most compelling way Australia can show leadership for the new economy is to recommit to the removal of fossil fuel subsidies. It's a stark example of unfinished and important business of the G20. If we are to reduce emissions and deal with global warming, while at the same time bringing in line new jobs in renewable energy and clean technologies, it makes no sense to be continuing to subsidise the extraction, exploration or use of fossil fuels. When in 2009 the G20 agreed, quote, to phase out and rationalise over the medium term fossil fuel subsidies while providing targeted support for the poorest, unquote, many people in the community cheered. Finally, there was something tangible that the G20 said it would do that people could understand and was clearly going to lead to a public good. And that's why people focused on it, and of course Australia signed up to it. At the time that they signed on to that leader's communique, which recognised the economic and environmental inefficiency of fossil fuel subsidies, the communique said this, quote, inefficient fossil fuel subsidies encourage wasteful consumption, distort markets, impede investment in clean energy sources, and undermine efforts to deal with climate change. The interesting thing is there, it went from the original wording to that, and that was not an accident. So saying inefficient fossil fuel subsidies encourage wasteful consumption. If it had said instead, fossil fuels are inefficient and encourage wasteful consumption, it would have been very clear. But the backroom boys had got to it, and by changing it to inefficient fossil fuel subsidies encourage wasteful consumption, then all you had to determine was that your fossil fuel subsidies were not inefficient and therefore don't need to be removed. And therein actually is the trickery that went on out of that communique and why countries have argued the toss ever since. And this lack of reform and action on these subsidies has gone on. And in the Australian context, when that first came out, Treasury identified 17 fossil fuel subsidies that we had in Australia. But after the argument about whether they were efficient or inefficient, you'll all be very pleased to know that Australia is now fully compliant because we have no inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. So what we need to do is get real about this and end fossil fuel subsidies. The International Energy Agency has said that getting rid of fossil fuel subsidies would not just be a win, but a triple win that would enhance energy security, reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, and bring immediate economic gains. It also advises that these subsidies, in many cases, create market distortions, imposing an unsupportable fiscal burden on government budgets and are weakening trade imbalances. And the numbers we're dealing with are huge. A new International Monetary Fund report urging policymakers to reform subsidies estimates that energy subsidies amount to a staggering $1.9 trillion worldwide, the equivalent of 2.5% of global GDP or 8% of government revenues. It argues that saying that removing these subsidies could translate into major gains for economic growth and the environment. So the list of global financial organisations lining up to push the benefits of ending fossil fuel subsidies go on. The OECD identified 550 measures that support fossil fuel production and use in its 34 member countries, and their value between 2005 and 2011 was estimated at $50 to $90 billion a year. So with such a chorus of support for the removal of these subsidies, it seems to me this is one very tangible step that the G20 could make in 2014 to deliver on its own agenda and to take a strong leadership stance to lead the rest of the world in a transition to a new industrial revolution based on clean energy, clean technology, and a shift away from growth driven by resource extraction. The Obama administration has recognised this with its recent announcement that it would like to pay for the expansion in clean technologies in part by eliminating tax breaks and subsidies for oil, gas, and coal industries. Whether it gets that through Congress is another question, but at least I applaud it as a shared goal, but I'm somewhat realistic about it when I see that particular pipeline that is going to attract a lot of subsidy in its own right. But instead of showing leadership on ending fossil fuel subsidies, Australia, as I indicated, was part of the redefinition to dodge obligations. And as I indicated, FOI documents showed the extent to which Treasury the extent to which they went to get that redefinition in place. The Greens have identified $12 billion in savings from ending four fossil fuel subsidies, the diesel fuel rebate for mining companies, export deductions, accelerated depreciation for mining assets, and direct funding of clean coal technologies. All that money could be reinvested into the industries that will create jobs and economic growth into the future. Now, one of the weaknesses of the G20 is its lack of reporting and accountability mechanisms for the decisions that it does make. While the G20 implemented the mutual assessment process, which tasks the IMF and other institutions to monitor whether the actions a country takes is actually consistent with the growth objectives agreed to at a G20 meeting, this process doesn't apply to other areas. And these third parties simply provide advice, and it's up to other G20 members to hold one another to account. These third party reports are then built upon by the Framework for Strong, Sustainable and Balanced Growth, which is colloquially referred to just as the framework when it comes to these meetings. This is when countries of the G20 actually cross-check each other's actions. I would argue that this process should be extended to other objectives of the G20, including climate and energy policies. And I know that the Lowy Institute has also recommended to the Australian government that the framework is extended to all policies agreed to by the G20 and not just limited to the macroeconomic decisions. And I welcome that, and I think that would be a big improvement and something that we could actually do in terms of improving governance and transparency and actually get people to be able to see there's some way of checking on delivery. Otherwise, these meetings are just communiques and statements, and there's not the follow through. One other area that I think that Australia should and could take a lead in is in terms of food security. As you would all be aware, this is something that Australia did put on the agenda in Mexico and did start to have this conversation at the global level. But I think it has somewhat faded in terms of the work of the G20, and I think it's an opportunity now to put food security back at the top of the agenda. And I think it needs to do it because we have to have a global conversation about the relevance any longer of free trade as opposed to fair trade in the consequence of global warming. And I say this because, as you would all know, in 2008, the world changed in terms of a global food crisis. And that occurred because of extreme weather events and climate change. And when there was a failure of the food system, several countries just took it upon themselves to stop the export of grain. That led to an inflated grain price globally. It led to massive speculation in food markets. And it then led to the riots in Tunisia, which began the Arab Spring. And very few people are aware that the riots in Tunisia started as food riots, because the Middle East is such an area dependent on the import of grain. And so when you see this conundrum that has gone on with global warming impacting on food availability or grain availability, and then massive speculation, and then insecurity and regional unrest, this is a major issue for us, and you can't pretend that the WTO has got it under control. It does not. As a result of that, what happened in 2008, many countries, wealthy countries, determined that it didn't matter how much money you had, if you couldn't buy grain because other countries decided to ban the export of it. And so that started the whole land grabbing, land and water grabbing globally. Hundreds of thousands of hectares being bought up around the world by countries not to engage in trade, but to secure, essentially outsource their own food supply when the extreme weather events jeopardise global food security. That is completely outside and around the current WTO, current free trade system. Now we've got even more manipulation of that land grabbing, because it's certainly the Chinese and the Saudis and the Qataris and so on have been involved in massive buy-ups of land and water. But now you've got European countries and the Americans using some of their major food corporates as part of their aid budgets to go in and buy up massive amounts of land, which is essentially getting themselves into making themselves global players in speculation and in also controlling food markets. So the whole food system is now in disarray, in my view. And it is no use sitting back saying, oh, we like free trade, and if we just had free trade, everything would be good. Everything has changed. And we need to actually use our influence to be able to support countries and communities being able to be self-sufficient in their own food. And helping women farmers in Africa is certainly one of the best, not just in Africa, but around the world, but assisting communities to be able to continue to produce on their own land and not be displaced by multinational food corporates or land grabbing corporates and so on is something that needs to be discussed. So I think when I hear people continuing to tell me about the benefits of free trade, I of course go back to the Productivity Commission report on the Australia-US Free Trade Agreement, which the Greens campaigned against in 2004, and I'm not in the least bit surprised that the Productivity Commission has come out and said, well, the benefits of that were wildly exaggerated from what actually happened. And I am really concerned that as Australia keeps focusing on free trade, you've got the United States now trying to stitch up two huge trade blocks in the world, which goodness knows where the WTO will sit in that, where you've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement negotiations on the one hand, and on the other hand, trying to stitch up an EU-US free trade agreement. So you'll end up with two blocks, essentially, and aid budgets being used in the course of all this to facilitate those the leadership in those blocks and the multinationals in those blocks. So I think it's time Australia did put food security back on the agenda, but ask the question, what is the relevance of the WTO? When are we going to get to fair trade instead of just free trade? And how are we going to guarantee that aid budgets genuinely do support people on the ground in those countries? And it's as Lester Brown has said recently, you know, food is the new oil. It's the new geopolitics this century, and I firmly believe that. So that land and water are the new gold. And that's how we should be considering and thinking about the politics around aid and food and the WTO and the whole issue of trade. And to suggest that this Australia's almost been an ideological zealot when it comes to free trade, and if you actually look behind it, so many other countries make those pledges towards free trade, but in fact there are all kinds of trade barriers that are maintained and in place. So I think that is an opportunity that we have got. Final issue I wanted to touch on was corruption. This is one that I think Australia needs to take a leadership role in, or else it's going to become a disgraced victim of. And I say that because last week I read in the newspapers here that the Australian African Mining Industry Group has explicitly argued for the ability to maintain facilitation payments to secure approvals for mining projects in Africa. Well, we've got a situation where we're effectively condoning corruption if we go down that path. It is not uncommon. In fact, there are endless scandals about what Australian companies have done overseas, but not just Australian companies. This is a worldwide phenomenon of paying facilitation fees. Now, as if Australia didn't suffer enough embarrassment through the AWB scandal, then the Securency scandal. Do we seriously want to be standing up in the G20 and saying that we don't uphold the OECD Convention Against Corruption? Are we seriously going to say that we think our mining companies should be able to pay facilitation fees, which by any other definition is a bribe? You know, the only difference between a bribe and a facilitation fee is the amount. It is not the fundamental intent in terms of that particular payment. And we've got a situation now where Canada and the UK have now got similar anti-corruption laws, and so Australian companies are going to find themselves caught up in the courts in the UK and in Canada as a result of joint ventures and so on into the future, unless we actually take a stand on this. And so in the Parliament, the Greens are going to take action to try and address this issue of Australian companies trying to avoid anti-corruption moves globally by maintaining facilitation fees. And that's why I think the presidency of the G20 does present us with an opportunity to take a stand and work with countries like Canada and the UK to end these insidious practices. As the G20 has noted already, corruption threatens the integrity of markets, undermines fair competition, distorts resource allocation, destroys public trust, and undermines the rule of law and is a severe impediment to economic growth. Well, Australia is going to have to uphold at least that in principle, and I think in practice is something else that we need to do. So just to conclude, I think we have got an opportunity next year to help chart a better future by using the opportunity of the G20 to actually talk about how we would measure green growth. What does that mean? Against what objectives? How is the G20 going to actually decouple what they determine to be growth from resource extraction? We can take a lead on fossil fuels. We can take a lead in a conversation starting, and let's face it, the G20 is a conversation. It's a conversation and it's communiques. It has no secretariat, no charter. It is within a United Nations system and other global institutions. But it's where the key conversations need to be held to drive change and enable those institutions to build enough of a consensus to be able to get outcomes. And if Australia can use the meeting next year to start building a consensus around the role of the climate in terms of where growth goes into the future, in terms of where and how aid might be distributed, how food security plays into that, what we do in terms of fossil fuel subsidies, I think that would be a tremendous opportunity, as well as to show leadership to say that if we're genuine about decoupling resource extraction from economic growth and the weight of our feet on the planet, then we also need to take a strong stand in terms of anti-corruption. And I think that's our opportunity: greater transparency, greater involvement of civil society, greater measurability, if you like, of whatever comes out of it. Otherwise, the G20 in Brisbane runs the risk of being what the G20 has been in other places, and that is a gated community of people who are separated from the real world, the physical world, and the people who live in it. And that is something we should avoid in Brisbane. We do not want to be a gated, you know, protecting a gated community that isn't being seen to be relevant in actually facilitating solutions, but rather continues to be part of the problem. Thank you.
Senator, thank you very much for your speech. I was personally delighted. I'm Mike Callaghan, from the director of the G20 Study Centre here, and I was personally delighted when you said you were going to come and talk about what you think Australia should be aiming to achieve when it chairs the G20 in 2014. As Michael said at the introduction, the G20 Study Centre, it's a recent addition to LOWI, and its focus is very much on this very issue of what trying to make a success of Australia's chairing of the G20. And so I spend my days working on the G20, and I'm described as just a G20 wonk. I'm sure it's a term of endearment, but we need more G20 wonks if Australia's hosting is going to be a success. We need, exactly as you said, we need more conversation. We need exactly the nature of what you've outlined here. So that's why I was so delighted that you were here talking on it. And in fact, I think you could probably be an honorary member of the G20 Wonk Club.
I'd like to be.
It's quite an exclusive club at the moment, but the challenge is to expand it. Yeah, and I love the analogy of a gated community, G20. It's just beautiful. I've spent a lot of time in G20 communique drafting sessions where you're in day and night in sort of down in the bunker, and you really do feel it's sort of a hostage situation rather than a gated, completely divorced. You don't know if it's light or day. Now, delighted.
Not in Parliament, really.
delighted that you're going to take questions. I'm going to take the lead. And please, could you just state your name and affiliation when asking a question? But I'm going to take the liberty of being moderator here on the questions to ask two questions to get in first. I thought you summed up the challenge at the very start when you said, and this is the whole challenge of getting any sort of cooperation anywhere in any international forum, that you're referring to the United Nations. You said it's national sovereignty defeats global cooperation. Mm. And what you've outlined in terms of the challenges for Australia to pursue, they're all controversial. They're all national sovereignty, really, on every one of them dominates in Australia here. So it really, you've got a very, very ambitious agenda if you outline. If you had to sort of focus, and if you wanted to have what would be the big takeaway from the Brisbane Summit, the main achievement, if you had to focus on one thing, or a couple of things. If you really said to Australia, put your big effort in a particular area that should be what the Brisbane Summit is remembered for, Australia's chairing of the Brisbane Summit, what would it be? That would be one question. The other one, I'll get a double barrel one here, is you did mention the importance, the question of the legitimacy of the G20 is a real issue. It is certainly 85% of global output, but there's 150 odd countries not there. Mm. And you mentioned so much that it can't be the United Nations and has to respect the United Nations. And one specific challenge you put forward was in terms of global climate change financing. You said that G20 could take a lead. Now, in 2014, how do you take a lead on it while respecting the UNFCCC? This has always been the challenge of trying to get it up, anything within the G20, because there's some there who say, hey, this shouldn't be the business of the G20. It's leave it all to the UNFCCC. So how do you overcome that problem of respecting the integrity of these international organisations, the United Nations, but the G20 using the fact that it is the major leaders coming together? How can you solve that problem?
Okay, the last one first, because that's the easier one in my view. The issue is, I've seen it as a participant in UNFCCC conferences for a very long time, is that the first week is a giant talk fest and it's great and there's lots of business and lots of community demonstrations and, you know, it's terrific and it's all that, but in terms of decision making, it's divorced from the decisions. The problem is that it's only environment ministers overwhelmingly who turn up, or climate change ministers who turn up as in the ministerial week. And if you're lucky, at the last minute, the leaders might fly in. They did fly in for Copenhagen, but they normally don't. So you don't have the people at the UNFCCC meetings in the end who are ultimately going to make the decisions, because they protect themselves on national sovereignty grounds by making decisions that they then have to get ratified at home, and it ends not happening. So the G20, because it's actually got the leaders in the room, if they came together in Brisbane and made some in principle agreement about climate financing, which they then undertook, they would feed through their ministers into the UNFCCC process as a key component of achieving the 2015 treaty, then that would make a big difference, because it would reverse the onus. So instead of it having to come up through the process after in the negotiations of 2015 treaty, you would actually start from the process of prime ministers and presidents and so on agreeing in Brisbane that the, not just saying it's a great idea to have so many billion dollars of finance available on the climate, but actually some more concrete view that they feed through with a view to saying we want this to be part of what comes out in 2015. So I really think it's that. It's not trying to supersede that, but trying to actually give the UNFCCC process the confidence that the leadership will fulfil or condones or wants to drive that outcome at the end. And that's been my big concern about UN processes and convention meetings and things. I mean, the Biodiversity Convention, for example, is a sideshow. You hardly ever get any leaders there, and yet you're losing species across the planet at a great rate. So getting the leadership engaged is half the problem in terms of, and not flying them in at the last minute as happened in Copenhagen, but getting some direction from them ahead of it, I think would be very useful. And it will be ahead of the 2014 UNFCCC, which will be the main preparatory for the 2015 at UNFCCC. So that's that one. On the second one, in terms of what is the one thing Australia can do, I guess I would like to answer that by, because I'm a politician, I can't just have one thing. But one really practical thing that people could understand that will be a focus of the meeting next year, and there will be NGOs from not only Australia and around the world, but is the fossil fuel subsidies. It's straight, it's definite, it's something that's measurable, achievable. So I'd be saying, let's deal with that and let's set up a process to make it measurable, not just agree to it, but make it measurable. And then in the broader thing, set up some process that actually defines the green pillar of what green growth is. Because until we have that, you can have every multinational on the planet with their page at the front of their social and environmental and ethical responsibility sheets and so on saying what they think it is. But let's actually have a realistic view about decoupling economic growth from resource extraction, and that would be an energy use. That would be a major step forward in getting a conversation globally in the economics community about what growth is. And until we have that, we're back to the Club of Rome.
Okay, thank you. Please, questions. Please.
Are we using the mic?
Yes, Michael.
Good afternoon, Senator Miller. My name's Nancy Waits. I'm from World Vision Australia. Firstly, I just wanted to say thank you for your supportive comments of international development aid, and in particular the announcement you made in your election platform release yesterday about reaching 0.7% of GNI by 2020. But to the matter at hand today, the G20, I wanted to respond to your comments about the importance of civil society engagement with the G20. And as you might be aware, the CEO of World Vision Australia has been appointed to chair a steering committee, which has been given the task of running an inclusive process of policy dialogue between civil society and the G20. And I just wanted to point out that on that steering committee, there is the CEO of the World Wildlife Fund, Dermot O'Gorman, and so environmental issues will be very much a part of that process. But also bearing in mind that some people may prefer to actually protest outside of that or make their views heard outside of that process, and that's also the democratic right, and we understand that as part of the C20 process. There'll be multiple tracks, but the C20 is about engaging in policy dialogue with the G20. But finally, to a question, sorry for the long journey there, but I just wanted to make sure that people knew that there is going to be civil society engagement with the G20. But the question was around your comments on aid being used to buy up land in a land grab type way. I haven't been aware of that, so I'd be really interested to hear a bit more about what that is and how that's taking place.
Okay. So thank you for that clarification about the chair and civil society engagement. We haven't heard from WWF as to how they intend to engage the environment groups around the country, but we'll certainly be talking to them because I think it's important. And I also agree that there will be big protests outside around coal seam gas and the Barrier Reef and fossil fuel subsidies, and that'll be colourful and good. But it won't be angry if people are also inside the tent. That's, I think, the difference in terms of what has happened in other places. In terms of the land grabs, I will send you a link to that, but essentially what's been happening is countries have been tying their aid to the advancement of particular corporates in their particular countries. And I hadn't realised either until I started looking at this, the extent to which companies are now buying up large tracts of land. And that goes to the displacement of the small farmers there and, of course, making them more vulnerable to famine in the longer term because what's produced there will be traded, but there'll be no benefits locally.
Yes, down the back.
Diane Hiles, New South Wales Greens. Christine, it was really interesting you went back to 2009 and the GFC and how we have seemingly recovered back to business as usual without addressing some of the issues that the G20 identified there in terms of tax haven, money laundering, greater regulation of the banks. It's almost as though the whole thing hasn't happened. And if I can just grab another barrel as our question master. Apropos the development issues, in Europe, the idea of a Robin Hood tax is really catching on. This has an impact on banking, but it also means it can give dividends that are very useful for energy efficiency projects and overseas development projects. But in any campaign, it's impossible to have it implemented without the G20 backing. And Australia, it's not even on the radar, but is this something that we can include in our vision?
Okay, so the first one on tax havens and also multinational corporates who are basically transferring their profits around the planet so that they don't pay tax anywhere where it really would hurt them. We, the Greens, have had conversations with the government in relation to this matter. The government has moved on tax havens, and it is moving to develop legislation in terms of tax liabilities proportionate to economic activities in a particular country. And I understand we had hoped, the government had said they would legislate before the election. It hasn't got to that. They're still in the process of consultation. But I can say that the Labor Party has said that it will bring out an interim report on the extent to which that's occurring. And this is really, this is the Google, et cetera, issue. And they're supposed to be bringing out an interim report by the middle of this year. So I'm assuming that it's not too far away and it may come out post-election. But we're on board with that, but I can't tell you how far the government wants to go with it. In terms of the G20, and again, this is the leadership issue when it comes to this issue of subsidies and so on. The G20, in its discussions of food security, determined that they were worried about food speculation and the amount of land that was being used to displace food crops to go to fuel crops. So they commissioned a report on that, which was a good idea. And then the report came back and recommended that there should be an end to mandating biofuels. Right? So the report that the G20 asked for came back and said, this needs to stop. You have to stop mandating the use of biofuels because that is driving the displacement of food crops around the world. And the G20 decided that they would not do that. And they effectively vetoed that by making a decision that they wouldn't accept that recommendation. So in many ways, they have to give up that veto power. And it's not a formal veto because, as Michael said, they don't have a formal charter or a formal capacity. But if you are a nation state or the European Union and the G20 has set, you've already mandated a certain use of a percentage of biofuels, and then the G20 comes out and rejects that as a recommendation, then it effectively acts as a veto on changing it at a parliamentary or a regional level. So I think the G20 has to stop that behaviour in terms of if they ask for a report that gives them a recommendation which is clearly very strong and very much evidence-based, they ought not then to be using it as a way of vetoing the very action that they recognise needed taking in the first place. So I take your point on that.
Just add on that, when you talk about the G20 vetoed something or rejected it, it is a consensus body. And as such, you've got to get agreement from everyone. And I keep coming back to your phrase, as you said, national sovereignty defeats global cooperation. So it's how do you win those battles? Michael.
Michael Fulilove from the Institute. Senator, thanks for your very interesting address. In the Lowy Institute tradition of robust discussion, can I ask you a tough question?
Yeah, by all means.
Because I think you had one or two kicks at us on the way through. And can I draw you out on what seems to me to be a contradiction in your argument? And it follows on, actually, from one of the questions Mike Callaghan asked. On the one hand, you were very critical of the idea of small numbers of powerful countries taking decisions at the Copenhagen summit and elsewhere. And you said this very much goes against the UN principle of one country, one vote, which we realise has completely failed to solve all of the global problems facing the world. You said the UN can't feel undermined by the G20, the UN Secretary General and so on should be invited to all G20 members forever. On the other hand, you advocate a remarkably ambitious agenda for the G20, not just growth, jobs, investment, trade, which itself is enormous, but global warming, corruption, food security, aid, and perhaps some other issues. Now, my own view is that there's no way the G20 could possibly solve these, and if it were to take them all on, it would ensure that the G20 would die an agonising death. But if it did, wouldn't this be exactly the kind of example of powerful countries imposing its will on the rest of the world simply because of their economic weight, exactly what you disliked at Copenhagen? Or, in your view, can the ends justify the means?
No, I think the issue here is the UN system is in trouble, and the G20 in some respects is a response to the grindingly slow processes of the United Nations. And there is a recognition that decisions have to be made, and they have to be made a lot faster than the UN is capable of doing. And that was quite clear with the global financial crisis. If that had been left to a broader agency, nothing would have happened, or very little would have happened. So what people have realised with it, it's got the potential to bring people together to make decisions that can intervene in an emergency. But then its role beyond that is how does it actually facilitate change if the UN system can't reform itself? And I guess that's my big issue. I'm disappointed that the UN system has seemed incapable of reforming itself, and therefore the G20 is a response. Well, let's get a smaller group together of influential players, which actually almost represent, not quite, but we could include some, so that you get all the major negotiating blocks, if you like. Rather than just the most powerful countries, you should actually have the negotiating blocks, if you like. So you get a subset, if you like, of the UN processes. There is a halfway house between saying to the G20, you can make these decisions and make everybody else live by them, and that's why I said the veto power doesn't work for me in terms of asking for a report and then effectively rejecting it and vetoing action. But on the other hand, you've got to have some mechanism for driving the UN to get outcomes, and not just the UN, the other global organisations. And one of the best ways, as we all know, you can't have decision-making fora without subsets of that fora to actually get to a point where you can get consensus. And that's what I'd like to think that the G20 might be able to do, to get consensus around some key principles, which could then be fed back through, because it comes back, if they decided to disband the G20 and instead guarantee that they, as the political leaders, would attend these negotiations in a serious way and not just fly in at the last minute, but actually engage it, then you wouldn't need the G20 to the same extent as you do. So I guess that's my issue. It's not about being a decision-making body. It's about facilitating the broader bodies to come to conclusions because, as Mike said, they're consensus decisions the G20 reaches. If that could then go out into those bodies, then you'd actually get somewhere. But I despair of the UN being able to meet the challenges in the time frame. And I guess that's why the G20 is important, because we're in the critical decade for climate change. You know, if we haven't taken serious action by 2020, you can just call it quits in terms of the serious impacts for the planet in addition to what we're already suffering. So how are we going to get there? And we've got to get a subset of people who can make the decisions to make it happen. So I see it as an important institution, but I don't want it to be a sort of be-all and end-all decision-making, but rather a facilitation of getting better outcomes through the other UN processes.
Okay. Well, I think that's the end of the question, Senator. Can I thank you again very much indeed? As I said at the start, if Australia is going to make a success of its chairing of the G20, we need to have the type of discussions, the conversations that you've really helped generate, initiate here now. So thank you very much. If I use a term that Michael used a few times, is that if we're going to make a success of this, our politicians, our officials, and society generally in Australia, we're going to have to run a lot harder and a lot faster than we normally do if we really want to seize the opportunity that extends here. So thank you very much indeed. And before you go, I'd like to put in an ad for our next speech on the G20. On the 1st of August, we have Sharon Burrow, who's the General Secretary of the International Council of Trade Unions Confederation, I think it is, and she's coming to give her thoughts on the G20. So Sharon's a fully paid up member of the G20 Wonk Club. Oh, so it's a very good club, so you're glad you've joined it. So thank you very much indeed. Senator, thank you very, very much.